This is Audible.
Gildan Media presents Your Coach in a Box, affordable, life-changing audio programs.
Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Written by Charles Mackay, LLD. Read by Grover Gardner. Preface. In reading the history of nations, we find that, like individuals, they have their whims and their peculiarities, their seasons of excitement and recklessness when they care not what they do. We find that whole communities suddenly fix their minds upon one object and go mad in its pursuit, that millions of people become simultaneously impressed with one delusion and run after it till their attention is caught by some new folly more captivating than the first. We see one nation suddenly seized from its highest to its lowest members with a fierce desire of military glory, another as suddenly becoming crazed upon a religious scruple, and neither of them recovering its senses until it has shed rivers of blood and sowed a harvest of groans and tears to be reaped by its posterity. At an early age in the annals of Europe, its population lost their wits about the sepulchre of Jesus and crowded in frenzied multitudes to the Holy Land. Another age went mad for fear of the devil and offered up hundreds of thousands of victims to the delusion of witchcraft. At another time, the many became crazed on the subject of the philosopher's stone and committed follies till then unheard of in the pursuit. It was once thought a venial offense in very many countries of Europe to destroy an enemy by slow poison. Persons who would have revolted at the idea of stabbing a man to the heart drugged his pottage without scruple. Ladies of gentle birth and manners caught the contagion of murder, until poisoning under their auspices became quite fashionable. Some delusions, though notorious to all the world, have subsisted for ages, flourishing as widely among civilized and polished nations as among the early barbarians with whom they originated, that of dueling, for instance, and the belief in omens and divination of the future, which seem to defy the progress of knowledge to eradicate them entirely from the popular mind. Money, again, has often been a cause of the delusion of multitudes. Sober nations have all at once become desperate gamblers and risked almost their existence upon the turn of a piece of paper. To trace the history of the most prominent of these delusions is the object of the present pages. Men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one. Some of the subjects introduced may be familiar to the reader, but the author hopes that sufficient novelty of detail will be found even in these to render them acceptable, while they could not be wholly omitted in justice to the subject of which it was proposed to treat. The memoirs of the South Sea Madness and the Mississippi Delusion are more complete and copious than are to be found elsewhere. And the same may be said of the history of the Witch Mania, which contains an account of its terrific progress in Germany, a part of the subject which has been left comparatively untouched by Sir Walter Scott in his Letters on Demonology and Witchcraft, the most important that have yet appeared on this fearful but most interesting subject. Popular delusions began so early, spread so widely, and have lasted so long that instead of two or three volumes, 50 would scarcely suffice to detail their history. The present may be considered more of a miscellany of delusions than a history, a chapter only in the great and awful book of human folly which yet remains to be written, and which Porson once jestingly said he would write in 500 volumes. Interspersed are sketches of some lighter matters, amusing instances of the imitativeness and wrong-headedness of the people, rather than examples of folly and delusion. Religious matters have been purposely excluded as incompatible with the limits prescribed to the present work. A mere list of them would alone be sufficient to occupy a volume. Money Mania, the Mississippi Scheme. Some in clandestine companies combine, erect new stocks to trade beyond the line, with air and empty names beguile the town, and raise new credits first, then cry 'em down. Divide the empty nothing into shares, and set the crowd together by the ears. Defoe. The personal character and career of one man are so intimately connected with the great scheme of the years 1719 and 1720 that a history of the Mississippi Madness can have no fitter introduction than a sketch of the life of its great author, John Law. Historians are divided in opinion as to whether they should designate him a knave or a madman. Both epithets were unsparingly applied to him in his lifetime, and while the unhappy consequences of his projects were still deeply felt. Posterity, however, has found reason to doubt the justice of the accusation and to confess that John Law was neither knave nor madman, but one more deceived than deceiving, more sinned against than sinning. He was thoroughly acquainted with the philosophy and true principles of credit. He understood the monetary question better than any man of his day, and if his system fell with a crash so tremendous, it was not so much his fault as that of the people amongst whom he had erected it. He did not calculate upon the avaricious frenzy of a whole nation. He did not see that confidence, like mistrust, could be increased almost ad infinitum, and that hope was as extravagant as fear. How was he to foretell that the French people, like the man in the fable, would kill in their frantic eagerness the fine goose he had brought to lay them so many golden eggs? His fate was like that which may be supposed to have overtaken the first adventurous boatman who rowed from Erie to Ontario. Broad and smooth was the river on which he embarked, rapid and pleasant was his progress, and who was to stay him in his career? Alas for him, the cataract was nigh. He saw, when it was too late, that the tide which wafted him so joyously along was a tide of destruction. And when he endeavored to retrace his way, he found that the current was too strong for his weak efforts to stem, and that he drew nearer every instant to the tremendous falls. Down he went over the sharp rocks, and the waters with him. He was dashed to pieces with his bark, but the waters, maddened and turned to foam by the rough descent, only boiled and bubbled for a time, and then flowed on again as smoothly as ever. Just so it was with Law and the French people. He was the boatman, and they were the waters. John Law was born at Edinburgh in the year 1671. His father was the younger son of an ancient family in Fife, and carried on the business of a goldsmith and banker. He amassed considerable wealth in his trade, sufficient to enable him to gratify the wish, so common among his countrymen, of adding a territorial designation to his name. He purchased with this view the estates of Lauriston and Randleston, on the Frith of Forth, on the borders of West and Midlothian, and was thenceforth known as Law of Lauriston. The subject of our memoir, being the eldest son, was received into his father's counting house at the age of 14, and for 3 years labored hard to acquire an insight into the principles of banking as then carried on in Scotland. He had always manifested great love for the study of numbers, and his proficiency in the mathematics was considered extraordinary in one of his tender years. At the age of 17, he was tall, strong, and well-made, and his face, although deeply scarred with the smallpox, was agreeable in its expression and full of intelligence. At this time he began to neglect his business, and becoming vain of his person, indulged in considerable extravagance of attire. He was a great favorite with the ladies, by whom he was called Beau Law, while the other sex, despising his foppery, nicknamed him Jessamy John. At the death of his father, which happened in 1688, he withdrew entirely from the desk, which had become so irksome, and being possessed of the revenues of the paternal estate of Lauriston, proceeded to London to see the world. He was now very young, very vain, good-looking, tolerably rich, and quite uncontrolled. It is no wonder that on his arrival in the capital he should launch out into extravagance. He soon became a regular frequenter of the gaming houses, and by pursuing a certain plan based upon some abstruse calculation of chances, he contrived to gain considerable sums. All the gamblers envied him his luck, and many made it a point to watch his play and stake their money on the same chances. In affairs of gallantry, he was equally fortunate. ladies of the first rank smiled graciously upon the handsome Scotchman, the young, the rich, the witty, and the obliging. But all these successes only paved the way for reverses. After he had been for 9 years exposed to the dangerous attractions of the gay life he was leading, he became an irrecoverable gambler. As his love of play increased in violence, it diminished in prudence. Great losses were only to be repaired by still greater ventures, and one unhappy day he lost more than he could repay without mortgaging his family estate. To that step he was driven at last. At the same time, his gallantry brought him into trouble. A love affair or slight flirtation with a lady of the name of Villiers, Miss Elizabeth Villiers, afterwards Countess of Orkney, exposed him to the resentment of a Mr. Wilson, by whom he was challenged to fight a duel. Law accepted and had the ill fortune to shoot his antagonist dead upon the spot. He was arrested the same day and brought to trial for murder by the relatives of Mr. Wilson. He was afterwards found guilty and sentenced to death. The sentence was commuted to a fine upon the ground that the offense only amounted to manslaughter. An appeal being lodged by a brother of the deceased, Law was detained in the King's Bench, whence, by some means or other, which he never explained, he contrived to escape, and an action being instituted against the sheriffs, he was advertised in the Gazette, and a reward offered for his apprehension. He was described as Captain John Law, a Scotchman, aged 26, a very tall, black, lean man, well-shaped, above 6 feet high, with large pockholes in his face, big-nosed and speaking broad and loud. As this was rather a caricature than a description of him, it has been supposed that it was drawn up with a view to favor his escape. He succeeded in reaching the continent, where he traveled for 3 years and devoted much of his attention to the monetary and banking affairs of the countries through which he passed. He stayed a few months in Amsterdam and speculated to some extent in the funds. His mornings were devoted to the study of finance and the principles of trade, and his evenings to the gaming house. It is generally believed that he returned to Edinburgh in the year 1700. It is certain that he published in that city his Proposals and Reasons for Constituting a Council of Trade. This pamphlet did not excite much attention. In a short time afterwards, he published a project for establishing what he called a land bank. The wits of the day called it a sand bank, which would wreck the vessel of the state. The notes issued by which were never to exceed the value of the entire lands of the state, upon ordinary interest, or were to be equal in value to the land with the right to enter into possession at a certain time. The project excited a good deal of discussion in the Scottish Parliament, and a motion for the establishment of such a bank was brought forward by a neutral party called the Squadron, whom Law had interested in his favor. The Parliament ultimately passed a resolution to the effect that to establish any kind of paper credit so as to force it to pass was an improper expedient for the nation. Upon the failure of this project and of his efforts to procure a pardon for the murder of Mr. Wilson, Law withdrew to the continent and resumed his old habits of gaming. For 14 years he continued to roam about, in Flanders, Holland, Germany, Hungary, Italy, and France. He soon became intimately acquainted with the extent of the trade and resources of each, and daily more confirmed in his opinion that no country could prosper without a paper currency. During the whole of this time, he appears to have chiefly supported himself by successful play. At every gambling house of note in the capitals of Europe, he was known and appreciated as one better skilled in the intricacies of chance than any other man of the day. It is stated in the Biographie Universelle that he was expelled first from Venice and afterwards from Genoa by the magistrates, who thought him a visitor too dangerous for the youth of those cities. During his residence in Paris, he rendered himself obnoxious to D'Argenson, the lieutenant general of the police, by whom he was ordered to quit the capital. This did not take place, however, before he had made the acquaintance in the saloons of the Duc de Vendôme, the Prince de Conti, and of the gay Duke of Orléans, the latter of whom was destined afterwards to exercise so much influence over his fate. The Duke of Orléans was pleased with the vivacity and good sense of the Scottish adventurer, while the latter was no less pleased with the wit and amiability of a prince who promised to become his patron. They were often thrown into each other's society, and Law seized every opportunity to instill his financial doctrines into the mind of one whose proximity to the throne pointed him out as destined, at no very distant date, to play an important part in the government. Shortly after the death of Louis XIV, or as some say in 1708, Law proposed a scheme of finance to Desmarais, the comptroller. Louis is reported to have inquired whether the projector were a Catholic, and on being answered in the negative, to have declined having anything to do with him. This anecdote, which is related in the correspondence of Madame de Bavière, Duchess of Orléans and mother of the regent, is discredited by Lord John Russell in his History of the Principal States of Europe from the Peace of Utrecht. For what reason, he does not inform us. There is no doubt that Law proposed his scheme to Desmarais and that Louis refused to hear of it. The reason given for the refusal is quite consistent with the character of that bigoted and tyrannical monarch. It was after this repulse that he visited Italy. His mind being still occupied with schemes of finance, he proposed to Victor Amadeus, Duke of Savoy, to establish his land bank in that country. The Duke replied that his dominions were too circumscribed for the execution of so great a project, and that he was by far too poor a potentate to be ruined. He advised him, however, to try the King of France once more, for he was sure, if he knew anything of the French character, that the people would be delighted with a plan not only so new but so plausible. Louis XIV died in 1715, and the heir to the throne being an infant only 7 years of age, the Duke of Orléans assumed the reins of government as regent during his minority. Law now found himself in a more favorable position. The tide in his affairs had come, which, taken at the flood, was to waft him on to fortune. The regent was his friend, already acquainted with his theory and pretensions, and inclined, moreover, to aid him in any efforts to restore the wounded credit of France, bowed down to the earth by the extravagance of the long reign of Louis XIV. Hardly was that monarch laid in his grave ere the popular hatred, suppressed so long, burst forth against his memory. He who, during his life, had been flattered with an excess of adulation to which history scarcely offers a parallel, was now cursed as a tyrant, a bigot, and a plunderer. His statues were pelted and disfigured, his effigies torn down amid the execrations of the populace, and his name rendered synonymous with selfishness and oppression. The glory of his arms was forgotten, and nothing was remembered but his reverses, his extravagance, and his cruelty. The finances of the country were in a state of the utmost disorder. A profuse and corrupt monarch, whose profuseness and corruption were imitated by almost every functionary from the highest to the lowest grade, had brought France to the verge of ruin. The national debt amounted to 3,000 millions of livres, the revenue to 145 millions, and the expenses of government to 142 millions per annum, leaving only 3 millions to pay the interest upon 3,000 millions. The first care of the regent was to discover a remedy for an evil of such magnitude, and a council was early summoned to take the matter into consideration. The Duc de Saint-Simon was of opinion that nothing could save the country from revolution, but a remedy at once bold and dangerous. He advised the regent to convoke the States General and declare a national bankruptcy. The Duc de Noailles, a man of accommodating principles, an accomplished courtier, and totally averse from giving himself any trouble or annoyance that ingenuity could escape from, opposed the project of Saint-Simon with all his influence. He represented the expedient as alike dishonest and ruinous. The regent was of the same opinion, and this desperate remedy fell to the ground. The measures ultimately adopted, though they promised fair, only aggravated the evil. The first and most dishonest measure was of no advantage to the state. A recoinage was ordered, by which the currency was depreciated 1/5. Those who took 1,000 pieces of gold or silver to the mint received back an amount of coin of the same nominal value, but only 4/5 of the weight of metal. By this contrivance, the treasury gained 72 millions of livres, and all the commercial operations of the country were disordered. A trifling diminution of the taxes silenced the clamors of the people, and for the slight present advantage, the great prospective evil was forgotten. A chamber of justice was next instituted to inquire into the malversations of the loan contractors and the farmers of the revenues. Tax collectors are never very popular in any country, but those of France at this period deserved all the odium with which they were loaded. As soon as these farmers general, with all their hosts of subordinate agents, called maltotiers, from maltot, an oppressive tax, were called to account for their misdeeds, the most extravagant joy took possession of the nation. The Chamber of Justice, instituted chiefly for this purpose, was endowed with very extensive powers. It was composed of the presidents and councils of the Parliament, the judges of the courts of aid and of requests, and the officers of the Chamber of Account, under the general presidents of the Minister of Finance. Informers were encouraged to give evidence against the offenders by the promise of 1/5 part of the fines and confiscations. 1/10 of all concealed effects belonging to the guilty was promised to such as furnished the means of discovering them. The promulgation of the edict constituting this court caused a degree of consternation among those principally concerned, which can only be accounted for on the supposition that their peculation had been enormous. But they met with no sympathy. The proceedings against them justified their terror. The Bastille was soon unable to contain the prisoners that were sent to it, and the jails all over the country teemed with guilty or suspected persons. An order was issued to all innkeepers and postmasters to refuse horses to such as endeavored to seek safety in flight, and all persons were forbidden, under heavy fines, to harbor them or favor their evasion. Some were condemned to the pillory, others to the galleys, and the least guilty to fine and imprisonment. One only, Samuel Bernard, a rich banker and farmer general of a province remote from the capital, was sentenced to death. So great had been the illegal profits of this man, looked upon as the tyrant and oppressor of his district, that he offered 6 millions of livres, or £250,000, to be allowed to escape. His bribe was refused, and he suffered the penalty of death. Others, perhaps more guilty, were more fortunate. Confiscation, owing to the concealment of their treasures by the delinquents, often produced less money than a fine. The severity of the government relaxed, and fines, under the denomination of taxes, were indiscriminately levied upon all offenders. But so corrupt was every department of the administration that the country benefited but little by the sums which thus flowed into the treasury. Courtiers and courtiers' wives and mistresses came in for the chief share of the spoils. One contractor had been taxed in proportion to his wealth and guilt at the sum of 12 millions of livres. The Count Blank, a man of some weight in the government, called upon him and offered to procure a remission of the fine if he would give him 100,000 crowns. "Vous êtes trop tard, mon ami," replied the financier. "I have already made a bargain with your wife for 50,000. This anecdote is related by Monsieur de la Hode in his Life of Philippe of Orléans. It would have looked more authentic if he had given the names of the dishonest contractor and the still more dishonest minister. But Monsieur de la Hode's book is liable to the same objection as most of the French memoirs of that and of subsequent periods. It is sufficient with most of them that an anecdote be ben trovato. The vero is but a matter of secondary consideration. About 180 millions of livres were levied in this manner, of which 80 were applied in payment of the debts contracted by the government. The remainder found its way into the pockets of the courtiers. Madame de Maintenon, writing on this subject, says, "We hear every day of some new grant of the regent. The people murmur very much at this mode of employing the money taken from the peculators." The people, who, after the first burst of their resentment is over, generally express a sympathy for the weak, were indignant that so much severity should be used to so little purpose. They did not see the justice of robbing one set of rogues to fatten another. In a few months, all the more guilty had been brought to punishment, and the Chamber of Justice looked for victims in humbler walks of life. Charges of fraud and extortion were brought against tradesmen of good character in consequence of the great inducements held out to common informers. They were compelled to lay open their affairs before this tribunal in order to establish their innocence. The voice of complaint resounded from every side, and at the expiration of a year, the government found it advisable to discontinue further proceedings. The Chamber of Justice was suppressed, and a general amnesty granted to all against whom no charges had yet been preferred. In the midst of this financial confusion, law appeared upon the scene. No man felt more deeply than the regent the deplorable state of the country, but no man could be more averse from putting his shoulders manfully to the wheel. He disliked business. He signed official documents without proper examination and trusted to others what he should have undertaken himself. The cares inseparable from his high office were burdensome to him. He saw that something was necessary to be done, but he lacked the energy to do it, and had not virtue enough to sacrifice his ease and his pleasures in the attempt. No wonder that, with this character, he listened favorably to the mighty projects, so easy of execution, of the clever adventurer whom he had formerly known and whose talents he appreciated. When Law presented himself at court, he was most cordially received. He offered two memorials to the regent, in which he set forth the evils that had befallen France, owing to an insufficient currency, at different times depreciated. He asserted that a metallic currency, unaided by a paper money, was wholly inadequate to the wants of a commercial country, and particularly cited the examples of Great Britain and Holland to show the advantages of paper. He used many sound arguments on the subject of credit, and proposed as a means of restoring that of France, then at so low an ebb among the nations, that he should be allowed to set up a bank, which should have the management of the royal revenues, and issue notes both on that and on landed security. He further proposed that this bank should be administered in the king's name, but subject to the control of commissioners to be named by the States General. While these memorials were under consideration, Law translated into French his essay on money and trade, and used every means to extend through the nation his renown as a financier. He soon became talked of. The confidants of the regent spread abroad his praise, and everyone expected great things of Monsieur Loss. The French pronounced his name in this manner to avoid the un-Gallic sound aw. After the failure of his scheme, the wags said the nation was Las de Louis, and proposed that he should in future be known by the name of Monsieur Elas. On the 5th of May, 1716, a royal edict was published by which Law was authorized, in conjunction with his brother, to establish a bank under the name of Law and Company, the notes of which should be received in payment of the taxes. The capital was fixed at 6 millions of livres, in 12,000 shares of 500 livres each, purchasable 1/4 in specie and the remainder in billets d'état. It was not thought expedient to grant him the whole of the privileges prayed for in his memorials until experience should have shown their safety and advantage. Law was now on the high road to fortune. The study of 30 years was brought to guide him in the management of his bank. He made all his notes payable at sight, and in the coin current at the time they were issued. This last was a masterstroke of policy, and immediately rendered his notes more valuable than the precious metals. The latter were constantly liable to depreciation by the unwise tampering of the government. 1,000 livres of silver might be worth their nominal value one day, and be reduced 1/6 the next. But a note of Law's bank retained its original value. He publicly declared at the same time that a banker deserved death if he made issues without having sufficient security to answer all demands. The consequence was that his notes advanced rapidly in public estimation and were received at 1% more than specie. It was not long before the trade of the country felt the benefit. Languishing commerce began to lift up her head. The taxes were paid with greater regularity and less murmuring, and a degree of confidence was established that could not fail, if it continued, to become still more advantageous. In the course of a year, Law's notes rose to 15% premium, while the billets d'état, or notes issued by the government as security for the debts contracted by the extravagant Louis XIV, were at a discount of no less than 78.5%. The comparison was too great in favor of Law not to attract the attention of the whole kingdom, and his credit extended itself day by day. Branches of his bank were almost simultaneously established at Lyon, Rochelle, Tours, Amiens, and Orléans. The regent appears to have been utterly astonished at his success, and gradually to have conceived the idea that paper, which could so aid a metallic currency, could entirely supersede it. Upon this fundamental error he afterwards acted. In the meantime, Law commenced the famous project which has handed his name down to posterity. He proposed to the regent, who could refuse him nothing, to establish a company that should have the exclusive privilege of trading to the great river Mississippi and the province of Louisiana on its western bank. The country was supposed to abound in the precious metals, and the company, supported by the profits of their exclusive commerce, were to be the sole farmers of the taxes and sole coiners of money. Letters patent were issued, incorporating the company, in August 1717. The capital was divided into 200,000 shares of 500 livres each, the whole of which might be paid in billets d'état at their nominal value, although worth no more than 160 livres in the market. It was now that the frenzy of speculating began to seize upon the nation. Law's bank had effected so much good that any promises for the future which he thought proper to make were readily believed. The regent every day conferred new privileges upon the fortunate projector. The bank obtained the monopoly of the sale of tobacco, the sole right of refinage of gold and silver, and was finally erected into the Royal Bank of France. Amid the intoxication of success, both Law and the regent forgot the maxim so loudly proclaimed by the former, that a banker deserved death who made issues of paper without the necessary funds to provide for them. As soon as the bank, from a private, became a public institution, the regent caused a fabrication of notes to the amount of 1,000 millions of livres. This was the first departure from sound principles, and one for which Law is not justly blamable. While the affairs of the bank were under his control, the issues had never exceeded 60 millions. Whether Law opposed the inordinate increase is not known, but as it took place as soon as the bank was made a royal establishment, it is but fair to lay the blame of the change of system upon the regent. Law found that he lived under a despotic government, but he was not yet aware of the pernicious influence which such a government could exercise upon so delicate a framework as that of credit. He discovered it afterwards to his cost, but in the meantime suffered himself to be impelled by the regent into courses which his own reason must have disapproved. With a weakness most culpable, he lent his aid in inundating the country with paper money, which, based upon no solid foundation, was sure to fall sooner or later. The extraordinary present fortune dazzled his eyes and prevented him from seeing the evil day that would burst over his head when once, from any cause or another, the alarm was sounded. The Parliament were from the first jealous of his influence as a foreigner, and had, besides, their misgivings as to the safety of his projects. As his influence extended, their animosity increased. D'Aguesseau, the Chancellor, was unceremoniously dismissed by the regent for his opposition to the vast increase of paper money and the constant depreciation of the gold and silver coin of the realm. This only served to augment the enmity of the Parliament, and when D'Argenson, a man devoted to the interests of the regent, was appointed to the vacant chancellorship and made at the same time Minister of Finance, they became more violent than ever. The first measure of the new minister caused a further depreciation of the coin. In order to extinguish the billet d'état, it was ordered that persons bringing to the mint 4,000 livres in specie and 1,000 livres in billet d'état should receive back coin to the amount of 5,000 livres. D'Argenson plumed himself mightily upon thus creating 5,000 new and smaller livres out of the 4,000 old and larger ones, being too ignorant of the two principles of trade and credit to be aware of the immense injury he was inflicting upon both. The Parliament saw at once the impolicy and danger of such a system and made repeated remonstrances to the regent. The latter refused to entertain their petitions, when the Parliament, by a bold and very unusual stretch of authority, commanded that no money should be received in payment but that of the old standard. The regent summoned a lit de justice and annulled the decree. The parliament resisted and issued another. Again, the regent exercised his privilege and annulled it, till the parliament, stung to fiercer opposition, passed another decree, dated August 12, 1718, by which they forbade the Bank of Law to have any concern, either direct or indirect, in the administration of the revenue, and prohibiting all foreigners under heavy penalties from interfering either in their own names or in that of others in the management of the finances of the state. The Parliament considered Law to be the author of all the evil, and some of the councillors, in the virulence of their enmity, proposed that he should be brought to trial, and, if found guilty, be hung at the gates of the Palais de Justice. Law, in great alarm, fled to the Palais Royal, and threw himself on the protection of the regent, praying that measures might be taken to reduce the Parliament to obedience. The regent had nothing so much at heart, both on that account and because of the disputes that had arisen relative to the legitimation of the Duke of Maine and the Count of Toulouse, the sons of the late king. The Parliament was ultimately overawed by the arrest of their president and two of the councillors, who were sent to distant prisons. Thus the first cloud upon Law's prospects blew over. Freed from apprehension of personal danger, he devoted his attention to his famous Mississippi project, the shares of which were rapidly rising in spite of the Parliament. At the commencement of the year 1719, an edict was published granting to the Mississippi Company the exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, China, and the South Seas, and to all the possessions of the French East India Company established by Colbert. The company, in consequence of this great increase of their business, assumed, as more appropriate, the title of Company of the Indies, and created 50,000 new shares. The prospects now held out by Law were most magnificent. He promised a yearly dividend of 200 livres upon each share of 500, which, as the shares were paid for in billets d'état at their nominal value, but worth only 100 livres, was at the rate of about 120% profit. The public enthusiasm which had been so long rising could not resist a vision so splendid. At least 300,000 applications were made for the 50,000 new shares, and Law's house on the Rue de Quincampoix was beset from morning to night by the eager applicants. As it was impossible to satisfy them all, it was several weeks before a list of the fortunate new stockholders could be made out, during which time the public impatience rose to a pitch of frenzy. Dukes, marquesses, counts and their duchesses, marchionesses, and countesses waited in the streets for hours every day before Mr. Law's door to know the result. At last, to avoid the jostling of the plebeian crowd, which to the number of thousands filled the whole thoroughfare, they took apartments in the adjoining houses that they might be continually near the temple whence the new Plutus was diffusing wealth. Every day the value of the old shares increased, and the fresh applications, induced by the golden dreams of the whole nation, became so numerous that it was deemed advisable to create no less than 300,000 new shares at 5,000 livres each, in order that the regent might take advantage of the popular enthusiasm to pay off the national debt. For this purpose, the sum of 1,500 millions of livres was necessary. Such was the eagerness of the nation that thrice the sum would have been subscribed if the government had authorized it. Law was now at the zenith of his prosperity, and the people were rapidly approaching the zenith of their infatuation. The highest and the lowest classes were alike filled with a vision of boundless wealth. There was not a person of note among the aristocracy, with the exception of the Duke of Saint-Simon and Marshal Villars, who was not engaged in buying or selling stock. People of every age and sex and condition in life speculated in the rise and fall of the Mississippi bonds. The Rue de Quincampoix was the grand resort of the jobbers, and it being a narrow, inconvenient street, accidents continually occurred in it from the tremendous pressure of the crowd. Houses in it, worth in ordinary times 1,000 livres of yearly rent, yielded as much as 12 or 16,000. A cobbler who had a stall in it gained about 200 livres a day by letting it out and furnishing writing materials to brokers and their clients. The story goes that a hunchbacked man who stood in the street gained considerable sums by lending his hump as a writing desk to the eager speculators. The great concourse of persons who assembled to do business brought a still greater concourse of spectators. These again drew all the thieves and immoral characters of Paris to the spot, and constant riots and disturbances took place. At nightfall, it was often found necessary to send a troop of soldiers to clear the street. Law, finding the inconvenience of his residence, removed to the Place Vendôme, whither the crowd of agioteurs followed him. That spacious square soon became as thronged as the Rue de Quincampoix. From morning to night, it presented the appearance of a fair. Booths and tents were erected for the transaction of business and the sale of refreshments, and gamblers with their roulette tables stationed themselves in the very middle of the place and reaped a golden, or rather a paper, harvest from the throng. The boulevards and public gardens were forsaken. Parties of pleasure took their walks in preference in the Place Vendôme, which became the fashionable lounge of the idle as well as the general rendezvous of the busy. The noise was so great all day that the chancellor, whose court was situated in the square, complained to the regent and the municipality that he could not hear the advocates. Law, when applied to, expressed his willingness to aid in the removal of the nuisance, and for this purpose entered into a treaty with the Prince de Carignan for the Hôtel de Soissons, which had a garden of several acres in the rear. A bargain was concluded by which Law became the purchaser of the hotel at an enormous price, the prince reserving to himself the magnificent gardens as a new source of profit. They contained some fine statues and several fountains, and were altogether laid out with much taste. As soon as Law was installed in his new abode, an edict was published, forbidding all persons to buy or sell stock anywhere but in the gardens of the Hôtel de Soissons. In the midst, among the trees, about 500 small tents and pavilions were erected for the convenience of the stock jobbers. Their various colors, the gay ribbons and banners which floated from them, the busy crowds which passed continually in and out, the incessant hum of voices, the noise, the music, and the strange mixture of business and pleasure on the countenances of the throng, all combined to give the place an air of enchantment that quite enraptured the Parisians. The Prince de Carignan made enormous profits while the delusion lasted. Each tent was let at the rate of 500 livres a month, and as there were at least 500 of them, his monthly revenue from this source alone must have amounted to 250,000 livres, or upwards of £10,000. The honest old soldier, Marshal Villars, was so vexed to see the folly which had smitten his countrymen that he never could speak with temper on the subject. Passing one day through the Place Vendôme in his carriage, the choleric gentleman was so annoyed at the infatuation of the people that he abruptly ordered his coachman to stop, and, putting his head out of the carriage window, harangued them for full half an hour on their disgusting avarice. This was not a very wise proceeding on his part. Hisses and shouts of laughter resounded from every side, and jokes without number were aimed at him. There being at last strong symptoms that something more tangible was flying through the air in the direction of his head, the marshal was glad to drive on. He never again repeated the experiment. Two sober, quiet, and philosophic men of letters, Monsieur de la Motte and the Abbé Tarascon, congratulated each other that they, at least, were free from this strange infatuation. A few days afterwards, as the worthy abbé was coming out of the Hôtel de Soissons, whither he had gone to buy shares in the Mississippi, whom should he see but his friend La Motte, entering for the same purpose? "Ha!" said the abbé, smiling. "Is that you?" "Yes," said La Motte, pushing past him as fast as he was able. "And can that be you?" The next time the two scholars met, they talked of philosophy, of science, and of religion, but neither had courage for a long time to breathe one syllable about the Mississippi. At last, when it was mentioned, they agreed that a man ought never to swear against his doing any one thing, and that there was no sort of extravagance of which even a wise man was not capable. During this time, Law, the new Plutus, had become all at once the most important personage of the state. The antechambers of the regent were forsaken by the courtiers. Peers, judges, and bishops thronged to the Hotel de Soissons. Officers of the army and navy, ladies of title and fashion, and everyone to whom hereditary rank or public employ gave a claim to precedence were to be found waiting in his antechambers to beg for a portion of his India stock. Law was so pestered that he was unable to see 1/10 part of the applicants, and every maneuver that ingenuity could suggest was employed to gain access to him. Peers, whose dignity would have been outraged if the regent had made them wait 30 minutes for an interview, were content to wait 6 hours for the chance of seeing Monsieur Law. Enormous fees were paid to his servants if they would merely announce their names. Ladies of rank employed the blandishments of their smiles for the same object, but many of them came day after day for a fortnight before they could obtain an audience. When Law accepted an invitation, he was sometimes so surrounded by ladies, all asking to have their names put down in his lists as shareholders in the new stock, that in spite of his well-known and habitual gallantry, he was obliged to tear himself away par force. The most ludicrous stratagems were employed to have an opportunity of speaking to him. One lady, who had striven in vain during several days, gave up in despair all attempts to see him at his own house, but ordered her coachman to keep a strict watch whenever she was out in her carriage. And if she saw Mr. Law coming, to drive against a post and upset her. The coachman promised obedience, and for 3 days the lady was driven incessantly through the town, praying inwardly for the opportunity to be overturned. At last she espied Mr. Law, and pulling the string, called out to the coachman, "Upset us now! For God's sake, upset us now!" The coachman drove against a post, the lady screamed, the coach was overturned, and Law, who had seen the accident, hastened to the spot to render assistance. The cunning dame was led to the Hotel de Soissons, where she soon thought it advisable to recover from her fright, and after apologizing to Mr. Law, confessed her stratagem. Law smiled and entered the lady in his books as the purchaser of a quantity of India stock. Another story is told of a Madame de Bouchat, who, knowing that Mr. Law was at dinner at a certain house, proceeded thither in her carriage and gave the alarm of fire. The company started from table, and Law among the rest, but seeing one lady making all haste into the house towards him, while everybody else was scampering away, he suspected the trick and ran off in another direction. Many other anecdotes are related, which, even though they may be a little exaggerated, are nevertheless worth preserving as showing the spirit of that singular period. The curious reader may find an anecdote of the eagerness of the French ladies to retain Law in their company, which will make him blush or smile, according as he happens to be very modest, or the reverse. It is related in the Letters of Madame Charlotte Elisabeth de Bavière, Duchess of Orléans, Volume 2, page 274. The regent was one day mentioning, in the presence of D'Argenson, the Abbé Dubois, and some other persons, that he was desirous of deputing some lady, of the rank at least of a duchess, to attend upon his daughter at Modena. "But," added he, "I do not exactly know where to find one." "No," replied one in affected surprise, "I can tell you where to find every duchess in France. You have only to go to Mr. Law's. You will see them every one in his antechamber." Monsieur de Chirac, a celebrated physician, had bought stock at an unlucky period and was very anxious to sell out. Stock, however, continued to fall for 2 or 3 days, much to his alarm. His mind was filled with the subject when he was suddenly called upon to attend a lady who imagined herself unwell. He arrived, was shown up the stairs, and felt the lady's pulse. "It falls. It falls. Good God, it falls continually," he said musingly, while the lady looked up in his face, all anxiety for his opinion. "Oh, Monsieur de Chirac," said she, starting to her feet and ringing the bell for assistance, "I am dying, I am dying! It falls, it falls, it falls!" "What falls?" inquired the doctor in amazement. "My pulse, my pulse," said the lady. "I must be dying." "Calm your apprehensions, my dear madam," said Monsieur de Chirac. "I was speaking of the stocks. The truth is, I have been a great loser, and my mind is so disturbed I hardly know what I have been saying. The price of shares sometimes rose 10 or 20% in the course of a few hours, and many persons in the humbler walks of life who had risen poor in the morning went to bed in affluence. An extensive holder of stock, being taken ill, sent his servant to sell 250 shares at 8,000 livres each, the price at which they were then quoted. The servant went, and on his arrival in the Jardin de Soissons, found that in the interval the price had risen to 10,000 livres. The difference of 2,000 livres on the 250 shares amounted to 500,000 livres, or 20,000 pounds sterling. He very coolly transferred to his own use, and giving the remainder to his master, set out the same evening for another country. Law's coachman in a very short time made money enough to set up a carriage of his own, and requested permission to leave his service. Law, who esteemed the man, begged of him as a favor that he would endeavor before he went to find a substitute as good as himself. The coachman consented, and in the evening brought two of his former comrades, telling Mr. Law to choose between them, and he would take the other. Cookmaids and footmen were now and then as lucky, and in the full-blown pride of their easily acquired wealth, made the most ridiculous mistakes. Preserving the language and manners of their old with the finery of their new station, they afforded continual subjects for the pity of the sensible, the contempt of the sober, and the laughter of everybody. But the folly and meanness of the higher ranks of society were still more disgusting. One instance alone, related by the Duc de Saint-Simon, will show the unworthy avarice which infected the whole of society. A man of the name of André, without character or education, had, by a series of well-timed speculations in Mississippi bonds, gained enormous wealth in an incredibly short space of time. As Saint-Simon expresses it, he had amassed mountains of gold. As he became rich, he grew ashamed of the lowness of his birth and anxious above all things to be allied to nobility. He had a daughter, an infant only 3 years of age, and he opened a negotiation with the aristocratic and needy family of Douaz, that this child should, upon certain conditions, marry a member of that house. The Marquis Douaz, to his shame, consented and promised to marry her himself on her attaining the age of 12, if the father would pay him down the sum of 100,000 crowns and 20,000 livres every year until the celebration of the marriage. The Marquis was himself in his 33rd year. This scandalous bargain was duly signed and sealed, the stock-jobber furthermore agreeing to settle upon his daughter on the marriage day a fortune of several millions. The Duke of Brancas, the head of the family, was present throughout the negotiation and shared in all the profits. Saint-Simon, who treats the matter with the levity becoming what he thought so good a joke, adds, "The people did not spare their animadversions on this beautiful marriage," and further informs us that the project fell to the ground some months afterwards by the overthrow of Law and the ruin of the ambitious Monsieur André. It would appear, however, that the noble family never had the honesty to return the 100,000 crowns. Amid events like these, which, humiliating though they be, partake largely of the ludicrous, others occurred of a more serious nature. Robberies in the streets were of daily occurrence, in consequence of the immense sums in paper which people carried about with them. Assassinations were also frequent. One case in particular fixed the attention of the whole of France, not only on the account of the enormity of the offense, but of the rank and high connections of the criminal. The Count Dorn, a young brother of the Prince Dorn, and related to the noble families of D'Arenberg, de Ligny, and de Montmorency, was a young man of dissipated character, extravagant to a degree, and unprincipled as he was extravagant. In connection with two other young men as reckless as himself, named Mille, a Piedmontese captain, and one D'Estampes, or Lestang, a Fleming, he formed a design to rob a very rich broker, who was known, unfortunately for himself, to carry great sums about his person. The Count pretended a desire to purchase of him a number of shares in the Company of the Indies, and for that purpose appointed to meet him in a cabaret, or low public house, in the neighborhood of the Place Vendôme. The unsuspecting broker was punctual to his appointment, So were the Count Dorn and his two associates, whom he introduced as his particular friends. After a few moments' conversation, the Count Dorn suddenly sprang upon his victim and stabbed him 3 times in the breast with a poniard. The man fell heavily to the ground, and while the Count was employed in rifling his portfolio of bonds in the Mississippi and Indian schemes to the amount of 100,000 crowns, Miel, the Piedmontese, stabbed the unfortunate broker again and again to make sure of his death. But the broker did not fall without a struggle, and his cries brought the people of the cabaret to his assistance. Lestang, the other assassin who had been set to keep watch of the staircase, sprang from a window and escaped, but Miel and the Count Dorn were seized in the very act. This crime, committed in open day and in so public a place as a cabaret, filled Paris with consternation. The trial of the assassins commenced on the following day, and the evidence being so clear, they were both found guilty and condemned to be broken alive on the wheel. The noble relatives of the Count Dorn absolutely blocked up the antechambers of the regent, praying for mercy on the misguided youth, and alleging that he was insane. The regent avoided them as long as possible, being determined that, in a case so atrocious, justice should take its course. But the importunity of these influential suitors was not to be overcome so silently, and they at last forced themselves into the presence of the regent and prayed him to save their house the shame of a public execution. They hinted that the Princes Dorn were allied to the illustrious family of Orléans, and added that the regent himself should be disgraced if a kinsman of his should die by the hands of a common executioner. The regent, to his credit, was proof against all their solicitations and replied to their last argument in the words of Corneille. Le crime fait la honte, et non pas l'échafaud, adding that whatever shame there might be in the punishment he would very willingly share with the other relatives. Day after day they renewed their entreaties, but always with the same result. At last they thought that if they could interest the Duke de Saint-Simon in their favor, a man for whom the regent felt sincere esteem, they might succeed in their object. The Duke, a thorough aristocrat, was as shocked as they were that a noble assassin should die by the same death as a plebeian felon, and represented to the regent the impolicy of making enemies of so numerous, wealthy, and powerful a family. He urged, too, that in Germany, where the family of D'Arenberg had large possessions, it was the law that no relative of a person broken on the wheel could succeed to any public office or employ until a whole generation had passed away. For this reason, he thought the punishment of the guilty count might be transmuted into beheading, which was considered all over Europe as much less infamous. The regent was moved by this argument and was about to consent when Law, who felt peculiarly interested in the fate of the murdered man, confirmed him in his former resolution to let the law take its course. The relatives of Dorn were now reduced to the last extremity. The Prince de Robec Montmorency, despairing of other methods, found means to penetrate into the dungeon of the criminal, and offering him a cup of poison, implored him to save them from disgrace. The Count Dorn turned away his head and refused to take it. Montmorency pressed him once more, and losing all patience at his continued refusal, turned on his heel and exclaiming, "Die then as thou wilt, mean-spirited wretch! Thou art fit only to perish by the hands of the hangman," left him to his fate. Dorn himself petitioned the regent that he might be beheaded. But Law, who exercised more influence over his mind than any other person, with the exception of the notorious Abbé Dubois, his tutor, insisted that he could not in justice succumb to the self-interested views of the Dorns. The regent had from the first been of the same opinion, and within 6 days after the commission of their crime, Dorn and Miel were broken on the wheel in the Place de Grève. The other assassin, Lestang, was never apprehended. This prompt and severe justice was highly pleasing to the populace of Paris. Even Monsieur de Quincampoix, as they called Law, came in for a share of their approbation for having induced the regent to show no favor to a patrician. But the number of robberies and assassinations did not diminish. No sympathy was shown for rich jobbers when they were plundered. The general laxity of public morals, conspicuous enough before, was rendered still more so by its rapid pervasion of the middle classes, who had hitherto remained comparatively pure between the open vices of the class above and the hidden crimes of the class below them. The pernicious love of gambling diffused itself through society, and bore all public and nearly all private virtue before it. For a time, while confidence lasted, an impetus was given to trade which could not fail to be beneficial. In Paris especially, the good results were felt. Strangers flocked into the capital from every part, bent not only upon making money but on spending it. The Duchess of Orléans, mother of the regent, computes the increase of the population during this time, from the great influx of strangers from all parts of the world, at 305,000 souls. The housekeepers were obliged to make up beds in garrets, kitchens, and even stables for the accommodation of lodgers. And the town was so full of carriages and vehicles of every description that they were obliged in the principal streets to drive at a foot pace for fear of accidents. The looms of the country worked with unusual activity to supply rich laces, silks, broadcloth, and velvets, which, being paid for in abundant paper, increased in price fourfold. Provisions shared the general advance. Bread, meat, and vegetables were sold at prices greater than had ever before been known, while the wages of labor rose in exactly the same proportion. The artisan who formerly gained 15 sous per diem now gained 60. New houses were built in every direction. An illusory prosperity shone over the land and so dazzled the eyes of the whole nation that none could see the dark cloud on the horizon announcing the storm that was too rapidly approaching. Law himself, the magician whose wand had wrought so surprising a change, shared, of course, in the general prosperity. His wife and daughter were courted by the highest nobility, and their alliance sought by the heirs of ducal and princely houses. He bought two splendid estates in different parts of France, and entered into a negotiation with the family of the Duc de Sully for the purchase of the Marquisate of Rosny. His religion being an obstacle to his advancement, the regent promised, if he would publicly conform to the Catholic faith, to make him Comptroller General of the Finances. Law, who had no more real religion than any other professed gambler, readily agreed, and was confirmed by the Abbé de Tonsin in the Cathedral of Melun, in presence of a great crowd of spectators. The following squib was circulated on the occasion. "Tonsin, a curse on thy seraphic zeal, which by persuasion hath contrived the means to make the Scotchmen at our altars kneel, since which we all are poor as Capucines." On the following day he was elected honorary churchwarden of the parish of Saint-Roch, upon which occasion he made it a present of the sum of 500,000 livres. His charities, always magnificent, were not always so ostentatious. He gave away great sums privately, and no tale of real distress ever reached his ears in vain. At this time he was by far the most influential person of the state. The Duke of Orléans had so much confidence in his sagacity and the success of his plans that he always consulted him upon every matter of moment. He was by no means unduly elevated by his prosperity, but remained the same simple, affable, sensible man that he had shown himself in adversity. His gallantry, which was always delightful to the fair objects of it, was of a nature so kind, so gentlemanly, and so respectful, that not even a lover could have taken offense at it. If upon any occasion he showed any symptoms of haughtiness, it was to the cringing nobles who lavished their adulation upon him till it became fulsome. He often took pleasure in seeing how long he could make them dance attendance upon him for a single favor. To such of his own countrymen as by chance visited Paris and sought an interview with him, he was, on the contrary, all politeness and attention. When Archibald Campbell, Earl of Isla, and afterwards Duke of Argyll, called upon him in the Place Vendôme, he had to pass through an antechamber crowded with persons of the first distinction, all anxious to see the great financier and have their names put down as first on the list of some new subscription. Law himself was quietly sitting in his library, writing a letter to the gardener at his paternal estate of Lauriston about the planting of some cabbages. The Earl stayed for a considerable time, played a game of piquet with his countryman, and left him, charmed with his ease, good sense, and good breeding. Among the nobles who, by means of the public credulity at this time, gained sums sufficient to repair their ruined fortunes, may be mentioned the names of the Dukes de Bourbon, de Guiche, de La Force, de Chaulnes, and d'Antin, the Maréchal d'Estrées, the Princes de Rouen, de Poix, and de Léon. The Duc de la Force gained considerable sums, not only by jobbing in the stocks, but in dealing in porcelain, spices, etc. It was debated for a length of time in the Parliament of Paris whether he had not, in his quality of spice merchant, forfeited his rank in the peerage. It was decided in the negative. A caricature of him was made, dressed as a street porter, carrying a large bale of spices on his back, with the inscription, Admirez la Force. The Duc de Bourbon, son of Louis XIV by Madame de Montespan, was particularly fortunate in his speculations in Mississippi paper. He rebuilt the royal residence of Chantilly in a style of unwonted magnificence, and being passionately fond of horses, he erected a range of stables which were long renowned throughout Europe, and imported 150 of the finest racers from England to improve the breed in France. He bought a large extent of country in Picardy and became possessed of nearly all the valuable lands lying between the Oise and the Somme. When fortunes such as these were gained, it is no wonder that law should have been almost worshipped by the mercurial population. Never was monarch more flattered than he was. All the small poets and littérateurs of the day poured floods of adulation upon him. According to them, he was the savior of the country, the tutelary divinity of France. Wit was in all his words, goodness in all his looks, and wisdom in all his actions. So great a crowd followed his carriage whenever he went abroad that the regent sent him a troop of horse as his permanent escort to clear the streets before him. It was remarked at this time that Paris had never before been so full of objects of elegance and luxury. Statues, pictures, and tapestries were imported in great quantities from foreign countries and found a ready market. All those pretty trifles in the way of furniture and ornament which the French excel in manufacturing were no longer the exclusive playthings of the aristocracy, but were to be found in abundance in the houses of traders and the middle classes in general. Jewelry of the most costly description was brought to Paris as the most favorable mart. Among the rest, the famous diamond bought by the regent and called by his name, and which long adorned the crown of France. It was purchased for the sum of 2 millions of livres. Under circumstances which show that the regent was not so great a gainer as some of his subjects by the impetus which trade had received. When the diamond was first offered to him, he refused to buy it, although he desired above all things to possess it, alleging as his reason that his duty to the country he governed would not allow him to spend so large a sum of the public money for a mere jewel. This valid and honorable excuse threw all the ladies of the court into alarm, and nothing was heard for some days but expressions of regret that so rare a gem should be allowed to go out of France, no private individual being rich enough to buy it. The regent was continually importuned about it, but all in vain, until the Duc de Saint-Simon, who with all his ability was something of a twaddler, undertook the weighty business. His entreaties being seconded by law, the good-natured regent gave his consent, leaving to law's ingenuity to find the means to pay for it. The owner took security for the payment of the sum of 2 millions of livres within a stated period, receiving in the meantime the interest of 5% upon that amount, and being allowed besides all the valuable clippings of the gem. Saint-Simon, in his memoirs, relates with no little complacency his share in this transaction. After describing the diamond to be as large as a greengage, of a form nearly round, perfectly white and without flaw, and weighing more than 500 grains, he concludes with a chuckle by telling the world that he takes great credit to himself for having induced the regent to make so illustrious a purchase. In other words, he was proud that he had induced him to sacrifice his duty and buy a bauble for himself at an extravagant price out of the public money. Thus the system continued to flourish till the commencement of the year 1720. The warnings of the Parliament, the too great a creation of paper money would, sooner or later, bring the country to bankruptcy, were disregarded. The regent, who knew nothing whatever of the philosophy of finance, thought that a system which had produced such good effects could never be carried to excess. If 500 millions of paper had been of such advantage, 500 millions additional would be of still greater advantage. This was the grand error of the regent, and which Law did not attempt to dispel. The extraordinary avidity of the people kept up the delusion, and the higher the price of Indian and Mississippi stock, the more billets de banque were issued to keep pace with it. The edifice thus reared might not unaptly be compared to the gorgeous palace erected by Potemkin, that princely barbarian of Russia, to surprise and please his imperial mistress. Huge blocks of ice were piled one upon another. Ionic pillars of chastest workmanship in ice formed a noble portico, and a dome of the same material shone in the sun, which had just strength enough to gild but not to melt it. It glittered afar like a palace of crystals and diamonds, but there came one warm breeze from the south, and the stately building dissolved away till none were able even to gather up the fragments. So with Law and his paper system. No sooner did the breath of popular mistrust blow steadily upon it than it fell to ruins, and none could raise it up again. The first slight alarm that was occasioned was early in 1720. The Prince de Conti, offended that Law should have denied him fresh shares in India stock at his own price, sent to his bank to demand payment in specie of so enormous a quantity of notes that 3 wagons were required for its transport. Law complained to the regent and urged on his attention the mischief that would be done if such an example found many imitators. The regent was but too well aware of it, and sending for the Prince de Conti, ordered him, under penalty of his high displeasure, to refund to the bank 2/3 of the specie which he had withdrawn from it. The prince was forced to obey the despotic mandate. Happily, for Law's credit, de Conti was an unpopular man. Everybody condemned his meanness and cupidity, and agreed that Law had been hardly treated. It is strange, however, that so narrow an escape should not have made both Law and the regent more anxious to restrict their issues. Others were soon found who imitated, from motives of distrust, the example which had been set by de Conti in revenge. The more acute stock jobbers imagined, justly, that prices could not continue to rise forever. Bourdon and La Richardière, renowned for their extensive operations in the funds, quietly and in small quantities at a time converted their notes into specie and sent it away to foreign countries. They also bought as much as they could conveniently carry of plate and expensive jewelry and sent it secretly away to England or to Holland. Vermalet, a jobber who sniffed the coming storm, procured gold and silver coin to the amount of nearly 1,000,000 livres, which he packed in a farmer's cart and covered over with hay and cow dung. He then disguised himself in the dirty smock frock or blouse of a peasant and drove his precious load in safety into Belgium. From thence he soon found means to transport it to Amsterdam. Hitherto, no difficulty had been experienced by any class in procuring specie for their wants. But this system could not long be carried on without causing a scarcity. The voice of complaint was heard on every side, and inquiries being instituted, the cause was soon discovered. The council debated long on the remedies to be taken, and Law, being called on for his advice, was of opinion that an edict should be published, depreciating the value of coin 5% below that of paper. The edict was published accordingly, but failing of its intended effect, was followed by another, in which the depreciation was increased to 10%. The payments of the bank were at the same time restricted to 100 livres in gold and 10 in silver. All these measures were nugatory to restore confidence in the paper, though the restriction of cash payments within limits so extremely narrow kept up the credit of the bank. Notwithstanding every effort to the contrary, the precious metals continued to be conveyed to England and Holland. The little coin that was left in the country was carefully treasured or hidden until the scarcity became so great that the operations of trade could no longer be carried on. In this emergency, law hazarded the bold experiment of forbidding the use of specie altogether. In February 1720, an edict was published which, instead of restoring the credit of the paper, as was intended, destroyed it irrecoverably and drove the country to the very brink of revolution. By this famous edict, it was forbidden to any person whatever to have more than 500 livres, 20 pounds, of coin in his possession, under pain of a heavy fine and confiscation of the sums found. It was also forbidden to buy up jewelry, plate, and precious stones, and informers were encouraged to make search for offenders by the promise of one half the amount they might discover. The whole country sent up a cry of distress at this unheard-of tyranny. The most odious persecution daily took place. The privacy of families was violated by the intrusion of informers and their agents. The most virtuous and honest were denounced for the crime of having been seen with a louis d'or in their possession. Servants betrayed their masters. One citizen became a spy upon his neighbor, and arrests and confiscations so multiplied that the courts found a difficulty in getting through the immense increase of business thus occasioned. It was sufficient for an informer to say that he suspected any person of concealing money in his house, and immediately a search warrant was granted. Lord Stair, the English ambassador, said that it was now impossible to doubt of the sincerity of Law's conversion to the Catholic religion. He had established the Inquisition after having given abundant evidence of his faith in transubstantiation by turning so much gold into paper. Every epithet that popular hatred could suggest was showered upon the regent and the unhappy Law. Coin to any amount above 500 livres was an illegal tender, and nobody would take paper if he could help it. No one knew today what his notes would be worth tomorrow. Never, says Duclos in his secret memoirs of the regency, was seen a more capricious government. Never was a more frantic tyranny exercised by hands less firm. It is inconceivable to those who were witnesses of the horrors of those times and who look back upon them now as on a dream that a sudden revolution did not break out, that Law and the regent did not perish by a tragic death. They were both held in horror, but the people confined themselves to complaints. A somber and timid despair, a stupid consternation had seized upon all, and men's minds were too vile even to be capable of a courageous crime. It would appear that at one time a movement of the people was organized. Seditious writings were posted up against the walls and were sent in handbills to the houses of the most conspicuous people. One of them, given in the Mémoire de la Régence, was to the following effect. Sir and Madam, this is to give you notice that a St. Bartholomew's Day will be enacted again on Saturday and Sunday if affairs do not alter. You are desired not to stir out, nor you nor your servants. God preserve you from the flames. Give notice to your neighbors. Dated Saturday, May 25th, 1720. The immense number of spies with which the city was infested rendered the people mistrustful of one another, and beyond some trifling disturbances made in the evening by an insignificant group, which was soon dispersed, the peace of the capital was not compromised. The value of shares in the Louisiana or Mississippi stock had fallen very rapidly, and few indeed were found to believe the tales that had once been told of the immense wealth of that region. A last effort was therefore tried to restore the public confidence in the Mississippi project. For this purpose, a general conscription of all the poor wretches in Paris was made by order of government. Upwards of 6,000 of the very refuse of the population were impressed as if in time of war, and were provided with clothes and tools to be embarked for New Orleans to work in the gold mines alleged to abound there. They were paraded day after day through the streets with their pikes and shovels, and then sent off in small detachments to the outports to be shipped for America. 2/3 of them never reached their destination, but dispersed themselves over the country, sold their tools for what they could get, and returned to their old course of life. In less than 3 weeks afterwards, one half of them were to be found again in Paris. The maneuver, however, caused a trifling advance in Mississippi stock. Many persons of superabundant gullibility now believed that operations had begun in earnest in the new Golconda, and that gold and silver ingots would again be found in France. In a constitutional monarchy, some surer means would have been found for the restoration of public credit. In England, at a subsequent period, when a similar delusion had brought on similar distress, how different were the measures taken to repair the evil. But in France, unfortunately, the remedy was left to the authors of the mischief. The arbitrary will of the regent, which endeavored to extricate the country, only plunged it deeper into the mire. All payments were ordered to be made in paper, and between the 1st of February and the end of May, notes were fabricated to the amount of upwards of 1,500 millions of livres, or 60 million pounds sterling. But the alarm once sounded, no art could make the people feel the slightest confidence in paper which was not exchangeable into metal. Monsieur Lambert, the president of the Parliament of Paris, told the regent to his face that he would rather have 100,000 livres in gold or silver than 5 millions in the notes of his bank. When such was the general feeling, the superabundant issues of paper but increased the evil by rendering still more enormous the disparity between the amount of specie and notes in circulation. Coin, which it was the object of the regent to depreciate, rose in value on every fresh attempt to diminish it. In February, it was judged advisable that the Royal Bank should be incorporated with the Company of the Indies. An edict to that effect was published and registered by the Parliament. The state remained the guarantee for the notes of the bank, and no more were to be issued without an order in council. All the profits of the bank, since the time it had been taken out of law's hands and made a national institution, were given over by the regent to the Company of the Indies. This measure had the effect of raising, for a short time, the value of the Louisiana and other shares of the company, but it failed in placing public credit on any permanent basis. A council of state was held in the beginning of May, at which Law, D'Argenson, his colleague in the administration of the finances, and all the ministers were present. It was then computed that the total amount of notes in circulation was 2,600 millions of livres, while the coin in the country was not quite equal to half that amount. It was evident to the majority of the council that some plan must be adopted to equalize the currency. Some proposed that the notes should be reduced to the value of the specie, while others proposed that the nominal value of the specie should be raised till it was on an equality with the paper. Law is said to have opposed both these projects, but failing in suggesting any other, it was agreed that the notes should be depreciated one half. On the 21st of May, an edict was accordingly issued by which it was decreed that the shares of the Company of the Indies and the notes of the bank should gradually diminish in value till at the end of the year they should only pass current for one half of their nominal worth. The Parliament refused to register the edict. The greatest outcry was excited, and the state of the country became so alarming that, as the only means of preserving tranquility, the Council of the Regency was obliged to stultify its own proceedings by publishing within 7 days another edict, restoring the notes to their original value. On the same day, the 27th of May, the bank stopped payment in specie. Law and D'Argenson were both dismissed from the ministry. The weak, vacillating, and cowardly regent threw the blame of all the mischief upon Law, who, upon presenting himself at the Palais Royal, was refused admittance. At nightfall, however, he was sent for and admitted into the palace by a secret door. When the regent endeavored to console him and made all manner of excuses for the severity with which in public he had been compelled to treat him. So capricious was his conduct that 2 days afterwards he took him publicly to the opera, where he sat in the royal box alongside of the regent, who treated him with marked consideration in the face of all the people. But such was the hatred against Law that the experiment had well nigh proved fatal to him. The mob assailed his carriage with stones just as he was entering his own door, and if the coachman had not made a sudden jerk into the courtyard and the domestics closed the gate immediately, he would in all probability have been dragged out and torn to pieces. On the following day his wife and daughter were also assailed by the mob as they were returning in their carriage from the races. When the regent was informed of these occurrences, he sent Law a strong detachment of Swiss guards, who were stationed night and day in the court of his residence. The public indignation at last increased so much that Law, finding his own house even with this guard insecure, took refuge in the Palais Royal in the apartments of the regent. The chancellor, D'Aguesseau, who had been dismissed in 1718 for his opposition to the projects of Law, was now recalled to aid in the restoration of credit. The regent acknowledged too late that he had treated with unjustifiable harshness and mistrust one of the ablest and perhaps the sole honest public man of that corrupt period. He had retired ever since his disgrace to his country house at Fresnes, where, in the midst of severe but delightful philosophic studies, he had forgotten the intrigues of an unworthy court. Law himself and the Chevalier de Conflans, a gentleman of the regent's household, were dispatched in a postchaise with orders to bring the ex-chancellor to Paris along with them. D'Aguesseau consented to render what assistance he could, contrary to the advice of his friends, who did not approve that he should accept any recall to office of which Law was the bearer. On his arrival in Paris, five councillors of the Parliament were admitted to confer with the Commissary of Finance, and on the 1st of June, an order was published abolishing the law which made it criminal to amass coin to the amount of more than 500 livres. Everyone was permitted to have as much specie as he pleased. In order that the banknotes might be withdrawn, 25 millions of new notes were created on the security of the revenues of the city of Paris at 2.5%. The banknotes withdrawn were publicly burned in front of the Hôtel de Ville. The new notes were principally of the value of 10 livres each, and on the 10th of June the bank was reopened with a sufficiency of silver coin to give in change for them. These measures were productive of considerable advantage. All the population of Paris hastened to the bank to get coin for their small notes, and silver becoming scarce, they were paid in copper. Very few complained that this was too heavy, although poor fellows might be continually seen toiling and sweating along the streets, laden with more than they could comfortably carry in the shape of change for 50 livres. The crowds around the bank were so great that hardly a day passed that someone was not pressed to death. On the 9th of July, the multitude was so dense and clamorous that the guards stationed at the entrance of the Mazarin Gardens closed the gate and refused to admit any more. The crowd became incensed and flung stones through the railings upon the soldiers. The latter, incensed in their turn, threatened to fire upon the people. At that instant, one of them was hit by a stone, and taking up his piece, he fired into the crowd. One man fell dead immediately, and another was severely wounded. It was every instant expected that a general attack would have been commenced upon the bank, but the gates of the Mazarin Gardens being opened to the crowd, who saw a whole troop of soldiers with their bayonets fixed, ready to receive them, they contented themselves by giving vent to their indignation in groans and hisses. 8 days afterwards, the concourse of people was so tremendous that 15 persons were squeezed to death at the doors of the bank. The people were so indignant that they took 3 of the bodies on stretchers before them and proceeded, to the number of 7,000 or 8,000, to the gardens of the Palais Royal, that they might show the regent the misfortunes that he and Law had brought upon the country. Law's coachman, who was sitting at the box of his master's carriage in the courtyard of the palace, happened to have more zeal than discretion, and, not liking that the mob should abuse his master, he said loud enough to be overheard by several persons that they were all blackguards and deserved to be hanged. The mob immediately set upon him, and thinking that Law was in the carriage, broke it to pieces. The imprudent coachman narrowly escaped with his life. No further mischief was done. A body of troops making their appearance, the crowd quietly dispersed, after an assurance had been given by the regent that the 3 bodies they had brought to show him should be decently buried at his own expense. The Parliament was sitting at the time of this uproar, and the president took upon himself to go out and see what was the matter. On his return, he informed the councillors that Law's carriage had been broken by the mob. All the members rose simultaneously and expressed their joy by a loud shout, while one man, more zealous in his hatred than the rest, exclaimed, "And Law himself, is he torn to pieces?" The Duchess of Orleans gives a different version of this story, but whichever be the true one, the manifestation of such feeling in a legislative assembly was not very creditable. She says that the president was so transported with joy that he was seized with a rhyming fit, and, returning into the hall, exclaimed to the members, "Messieurs, messieurs, bonne nouvelle, la carrosse de l'as est réduite en cannelle." Much, undoubtedly, depended on the credit of the Company of the Indies, which was answerable for so great a sum to the nation. It was therefore suggested in the Council of the Ministry that any privileges which could be granted to enable it to fulfill its engagements would be productive of the best results. With this end in view, it was proposed that the exclusive privilege of all maritime commerce should be secured to it, and an edict to that effect was published. But it was unfortunately forgotten that by such a measure all the merchants of the country would be ruined. The idea of such an immense privilege was generally scouted by the nation, and petition on petition was presented to the Parliament that they would refuse to register the decree. They refused accordingly, and the regent, remarking that they did nothing but fan the flame of sedition, exiled them to Blois. At the intercession of D'Aguesseau, the place of banishment was changed to Pontoise.